Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. The U.S. Supreme Court wrapped up its term today, issuing two big rulings on whether President Trump's financial records can be subpoenaed. And in the case of New York prosecutors, the answer was yes. In the case of Congress, the answer was to be determined. Both rulings were 7-2 opinions authored by Chief Justice John Roberts, with conservatives Thomas and Alito dissenting. The rulings have been highly anticipated in large part because they answer the question of whether voters will see President Trump's tax returns before the November election. And it appears that the answer to that question is no. So today, we're going to dig into those decisions and other consequential decisions during this longer than usual term. We'll also take a look at the role John Roberts is playing on the court and compare the court's opinions to public opinion more broadly. And here with me to do that is 538 senior writer and legal reporter Amelia Thompson DeVoe. Hey, Amelia.
Hey, Galen.
Let's start with the specifics of the Trump financial records cases. What does the ruling say about presidential power and immunity?
Yeah, so to recap for people who haven't been following these cases religiously, this is the result of a lengthy series of litigation resulting from a couple different attempts to get Trump's tax returns. So the subpoenas were not to Trump himself, they were to his accounting firm and his banks. And one of them was from a district attorney in Manhattan, and three of them were from various House committees. And Trump, in those cases, made some pretty sweeping arguments about his own immunity from investigation as president. In the case involving the New York prosecutor, he basically said, hey, while I'm president, you can't investigate me criminally. Sorry, take those subpoenas and throw them in the trash. And with Congress, he was making the argument that asking for his personal financial records doesn't fall under Congress's oversight power because they can conduct oversight for the purpose of legislating, and this doesn't fulfill that purpose. And the Supreme Court said to both of those arguments, like, basically, no, that's not how it works. In the case involving the New York prosecutor, they said pretty clearly that Trump does not get special treatment because he's president. And in the case involving Congress, they said, you know, Congress does have this power to issue subpoenas for oversight. We think that the courts below didn't really consider the separation of powers issues in this case well enough. Basically, both sides are presenting unsatisfying arguments. So that goes back to the lower courts for more litigation.
In the case involving the district attorney in Manhattan, does it seem like Trump's accounting firm will now have to turn over his financial documents to them?
I think what's going to happen is there's going to be a little bit more legal fighting, because in their ruling, the Supreme Court did leave open the possibility that Trump could throw some more arguments at this, just based in kind of the normal arguments that you or I as a citizen could throw at a subpoena. You know, it's not clear whether those will hold water, especially since the subpoena is not actually directed against Trump himself, which has been one of the challenges for him in all of this. It's about his accounting firm. So it's hard for him to say that, you know, this is really burdensome for him to produce these documents because he literally has to do nothing. But I think the first order effect will be there's going to be some more delay. There might be some more legal fighting as this gets worked out at the lower court level. And then maybe the prosecutors, you know, maybe that goes pretty quickly and the prosecutors do actually get the records. We're not going to see them because this was subpoenaed as part of a broader grand jury investigation. And as the lawyers made pretty clear during the oral argument, anything that happens during a grand jury investigation is private. So the chances that A, the documents will actually be turned over to the Manhattan DA, and B, that somehow that investigation will move to a stage where those would be made public, which actually may never happen, that all of that would happen before the election is vanishingly unlikely.
So in a practical sense of whether or not we're going to see President Trump's tax returns, no, unless there's a leak, I assume.
Right. And if there were a leak, I mean, you know, anything is possible. That would be pretty embarrassing for Vance. So I would assume that they're going to do whatever they can to make sure that those returns do not make it out into the newspapers or on TV.
What the Supreme Court did today, in part, is set up a standard for the circumstances in which Congress can subpoena the president's records. What kind of decision did it come to in when Congress can subpoena the president's documents and when it's really overstepping its bounds as the oversight branch of government?
They laid out some pretty specific considerations for the lower courts. And what they were basically saying is it's not insignificant that Congress is asking for the president's personal records. And you have to have a good reason to do it. And you have to make sure that this is not overly broad, that you're not asking for way more than you need. And that you have to basically find a balance between respecting Congress's legitimate oversight powers, which, you know, may include subpoenaing personal documents of the president, and not just wildly using this as, you know, a kind of fishing expedition attempt to go after the president, ask for way more than you need, and take a long time with it. So that's what the lower courts are going to have to consider. And it does suggest, I mean, you know, this will all kind of have to play out in the lower courts and we'll see what happens. But the strong message from the Supreme Court is Congress has this oversight power. We're going to state that again, but it's not limitless.
Both of these decisions were 7-2 opinions, with only Alito and Thomas, the most conservative justices on the court, dissenting. Was that kind of split surprising?
Yeah, I was a little surprised by that, actually. Obviously, in cases involving the president personally, the Supreme Court has historically tried to be unanimous, you know, thinking about cases involving the Watergate tapes or, you know, a sexual harassment lawsuit against Bill Clinton. The court really wants to come out with a full show of we're on the same page about this because those cases are a really big deal. That being said, I was really expecting at least one of these rulings to be 5-4 just because of how split the court is right now. And, you know, I think we can talk a little more about what this term looked like for Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, who are Trump's two appointees. But I think it's particularly significant that both of them were in the majority in these cases because it means something to have Trump's own nominees saying, basically, we don't buy this extremely expansive vision of presidential power that you are arguing for.
Yeah, let's dig into what we learned about the jurisprudence of Kavanaugh and Gorsuch this term. So we saw a little bit of how they think last term, although arguably this year's cases were significantly more consequential and in greater number. So what did we learn? And maybe let's start with Gorsuch, who was perhaps more surprising than Kavanaugh.
Yeah, Gorsuch is a little more interesting this term, at least if you're looking for people who surprise. So I think this term, Gorsuch really kept carving out this reputation as someone who's a textualist, who really cares about figuring out exactly what the law says. And that came out especially strongly in a ruling involving this question of whether sexual orientation is covered under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, whether the term sex includes sexual orientation and therefore employment discrimination is barred on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. You know, this is very easily a case where you could imagine the conservatives saying, no, you know, this is really an over-reading of this law. When they say sex, they're talking about women. They're not talking about sexual orientation. And, you know, this big achievement for gay rights would not have happened. That is not what happened. Both Gorsuch and Roberts ruled, along with the four liberals, that sexual orientation is covered for the purposes of employment discrimination. And Gorsuch wrote the opinion, which is kind of a big deal because he was the most junior justice in that majority. And he basically said, I'm reading this law carefully and I'm looking at the words, and these words mean that sexual orientation is covered. And then he did that again a bit today in a 5-4 ruling where he actually joined the liberals and there weren't any conservatives in the majority, involving a case about Indian lands in Oklahoma. And in that case too, he basically said, nope, We're looking at the language of this contract that the U.S. government made with the Creek Nation, and that contract is pretty clear that they have this land, and we're going to enforce that contract. And so, you know, I think it's worth noting that Gorsuch is from the West, and this is a place where I kind of love to point out, like, geographic diversity can matter on the Supreme Court, because Gorsuch had a lot of Indian law cases when he was a judge on the 10th Circuit. And so he tends in general to be more sympathetic to the claims of tribes when they're making arguments about land and contracts. So, you know, I don't think it was a terribly surprising ruling for Gorsuch, but the way he did it was very much in line with this sort of idea of him as a textualist. You know, I mean, I don't want to overstate how much of a surprise he is. For the most part, he is a pretty solid member of the conservative bloc. But I think we will continue to see these kind of idiosyncratic rulings where he breaks with the conservative bloc and he uses this textualist frame to do so.
And when it comes to Kavanaugh, you mentioned that perhaps it's a surprise that he joined Roberts, Gorsuch, and the liberals in these cases involving President Trump's financial records. Were there any other cases this term where we learned a significant amount about his jurisprudence that we didn't already know?
If you're a legal nerd, there's always more to learn from every term where we get more opinions and where the justices show more about how they think. But at a very high level, I think what we learned about Kavanaugh this term is that he's a pretty solid conservative. And the fact that he ruled with the majority in the cases involving Trump's tax returns is definitely really noteworthy. But it's not like he was the tiebreaker in that case. You know, he had two other conservatives in the majority with him. So I think Kavanaugh is just kind of, in a lot of ways, what people expected him to be, very solidly conservative, notably voted with the conservatives in a case about abortion, which is something that I think was pretty predictable based on his history, but is still noteworthy. You know, he doesn't seem sympathetic to abortion rights generally, and we found that out this term.
So we've been talking about two conservative justices who at times have split with their conservative colleagues on the bench. What are some of the divides that we saw amongst liberals this term, if there were any?
Everyone focuses on the conservatives, and that's for good reason. You know, they really have the power on the court right now. But the liberals are interesting, too, because just like the conservatives, they don't vote in lockstep. They don't all think the same way. And I saw that in particular this term with some cases involving religious liberty. People listening may be surprised to hear that the saga of the contraception mandate is still continuing. There have been a lot of legal cases about the contraception mandate from the Affordable Care Act, and the Supreme Court heard one this term that was basically about whether some exemptions that the Trump administration had put in for religious employers were kosher. And Breyer and Kagan, who are both part of the liberal bloc, voted with the conservatives in that case. And they also voted with the conservatives in another religious liberty case. And Elena Kagan continued to write in at least one other opinion about her desire to respect precedent. And she sort of really carved out a lane for herself as someone who says that precedent should really matter to the court, and sometimes to call out other justices when she thinks they're not respecting precedent sufficiently. So those divides are worth watching too, because this is a very divided court, and any place where there's compromise is noteworthy. And certainly Breyer and Kagan seem willing to come over and join the conservatives at least sometimes on pretty high profile cases.
I want to talk a little bit more about some of the consequential cases this term and about John Roberts' role in particular.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt
the cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia, Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
Now that Kennedy is off the bench and looking at the whole host of cases that the justices considered this term, is it fair to say that the court has become more conservative now that Roberts is the swing justice?
I want to say, first of all, we are still waiting for some very important data that will help us analyze exactly what was happening with all of the justices ideologically this term, where they are on the ideological spectrum, and how much they agreed with each other. So TBD on that. Check the site. I'll have some stories on that next week. But I think it is fair to say that the big conservative revolution that conservatives were excited about and liberals were kind of dreading when Kennedy was replaced by Kavanaugh is not here yet. There were definitely some significant conservative decisions, but in some of these very important cases, Chief Justice John Roberts in particular was holding the line against the court taking a kind of abrupt right swing.
And what were some of the key situations in which he did that?
Yeah, so one of the big cases this term was an abortion case involving a law in Louisiana that was basically identical to a law that was struck down in 2016 by the Supreme Court, is an abortion restriction. And I think people in the anti-abortion movement and the conservative legal movement were kind of hoping, you know, yes, there is this precedent from 4 years ago, but maybe we can make an argument, or they did make an argument, that this law is different enough that it should get through. And, you know, maybe the Supreme Court with this new conservative majority will be willing to take a step away from that precedent that was fairly recent. And Chief Justice John Roberts joined the liberals in that opinion. He didn't write the majority opinion, but he did write a concurring opinion where he basically said, I didn't agree with the ruling in 2016, and I don't agree with it now, but a precedent's a precedent. This law is the same, so we're striking it down. And, you know, I think on the one hand, not a huge surprise for the Supreme Court to not be eager to overturn or dramatically move away from something they decided 4 years ago. That's like not a good look for the Supreme Court in a lot of ways. But it was a sort of signal that John Roberts, at least, is not willing to move as fast to the right as a lot of people in the conservative legal movement probably would like him to.
I actually saw on SCOTUS blog this morning the statistic that John Roberts has sided with the majority opinion in 62 out of 64 cases this term. So he is often referred to as the swing justice. So if you're going to have a 5-4 decision, maybe it's not surprising that he's the one who's joining the majority. But is that high number, you know, almost 100% of the time he is on the deciding block on the court, is that unprecedented? And why is he doing that? Is it, I guess, could you say it's intentional?
Well, I wish I had a window into John Roberts' mind and could tell you why he's doing it exactly. I mean, it's really unusual to have an individual justice in the majority that much. I'm looking into this more with our quant editor, Laura Bronner, and we'll have more about this in a piece next week. But we looked at it a bit, and basically, you know, Kennedy did approach that level of being in the majority a few times while he was the swing justice. And it seems like Earl Warren, who was a chief justice back in the 50s and 60s, may also have sort of come close to that when he was chief justice. But it's certainly unusual. It may be unprecedented. And I think it just signals that John Roberts really has control of this court for now. And he's trying to sort of have this balancing act of, you know, he's still a very conservative guy. I think it would be a mistake to say that this term is evidence that he's changed the way he thinks ideologically. I mean, when we get the data, it may show that he's moved to the left a little bit, but we don't really have any evidence that he's like becoming dramatically less conservative or dramatically more liberal, or that he's a closet liberal or something like that. But I think what it does mean is that the court is very polarized. We're in an extremely polarized political moment. We're in a moment where the court is correctly perceived as having a majority of conservatives, and where Democrats are mad about that. You know, there was a significant amount of talk about court packing during the Democratic primary. I mean, like, whether that can actually be pulled off is a whole nother discussion. But the Supreme Court has been in the news, and discussion of changes to the Supreme Court have been in the news in ways that John Roberts probably does not love. And so being able to issue sort of as a whole a group of rulings that like don't really move outside public opinion and appear kind of balanced between liberal and conservative is good if you're concerned about preserving this idea that the Supreme Court is not just politicians in robes, as Supreme Court nominees are very fond of saying during their confirmation hearings, and that you can trust these people who have lifetime appointments to not be making decisions that are just in line with their political beliefs. And so, you know, with the caveat that obviously, like, John Roberts is not my friend, and I don't know exactly why he's doing all these things, he does have a reputation for really caring about the institution of the court. And I think this term makes a lot of sense if you see him as someone who is trying to kind of preserve the court's reputation in a moment when it is a little bit more fragile than it has been in the past.
Wait, but doesn't that in and of itself fly in the face of the idea that there is a sort of correct interpretation of the law that justices are supposed to spell out for us in their decisions? If presumably a chief justice could be making some decisions with the goal of matching public opinion, like, shouldn't that make us believe even less in this facade like there is a correct way to interpret the law and justices are just doing that correct thing?
So fair question. I want to be clear that I do not think John Roberts is like going to 538 or perusing the polls to try to figure out exactly where public opinion is on given issues. He has been pretty scathing about social science in general in the past. So
yes, we talked about this during gerrymandering. Sociological gobbledygook.
Yeah, like, I don't think the guy is a poll watcher. Not sure he reads the site. But I think in general, like, yeah, that's an argument you can make. And I think there are probably conservatives who are out there thinking to themselves, hey, John Roberts is supposed to be conservative. And look, all the other conservatives went one way on the abortion ruling and on the ruling involving DACA. It was another big case where Roberts ruled with the liberals to say that the Trump administration had basically not followed the correct process in trying to end the DACA program. And so, yeah, you can totally make the argument that it is itself political to take the institutional reputation of the court into account, even kind of vaguely, when you're making your decisions. On the other hand, I don't think we saw anything this term that is really radical from Roberts. You know, the idea that he would follow precedent in the abortion case, like, that was a really aggressive move to bring a basically identical law to the Supreme Court 4 years after they had already decided it. You know, he might have ruled differently on another abortion law. And with DACA, it does sort of seem to be important to him to tell the Trump administration that they really can't get away with completely ignoring the rules and procedures that the executive branch is supposed to follow when they are changing policies or issuing policies that affect people's lives in really serious ways.
Right. In that case, they said, Roberts at least said that, yes, you know, the Trump administration can end DACA if it wants to. It just did it the wrong way. Right.
Right. Exactly. And like, Trump administration, like, please just follow the rules was the kind of subtext of Roberts' ruling. So it's not like he was like, no, DACA is a great program and it should continue and yay DACA. But on the other hand, I mean, this is a debate that's been going on for a long time about whether the Supreme Court is a political institution and whether the Supreme Court is responsive to public opinion and whether it should be. And, you know, I think this is something that Roberts is in a unique position of being at the center of the court, being the Chief Justice whose name is on the legacy of anything this court does. So, you know, he's sort of thinking about, do I want to be perceived as the Chief Justice who did X? And also being in this, you know, moment where the ideological polarization of the other justices is really strong, and where the conservative bloc, I think we saw from this term, would go pretty far to the right if Roberts would go along with them. And I'm sure there are people who are thinking, you know, gee, in sort of having all these rulings on the left and the right, that he's actually making a political decision to try to make the court not seem political. And, you know, I think there's also an argument that maybe, you know, he's doing that because he really sees that as what the Supreme Court needs to be able to do its job. And also, maybe he's doing that so that 3 years from now, when another abortion restriction that the court has not just ruled on comes back to them, he has the leeway and the credibility to say, okay, well, 3 years ago, you know, I said I followed precedent and you all saw me do that. But in this case, there's no precedent saying that this abortion restriction isn't okay. And in fact, I think this abortion restriction is constitutional. And maybe sort of having that track record could help something that would be more controversial be less controversial, in theory. You know, I'm all kind of speculating. I have no idea if this is what he's actually thinking, but these are the kinds of considerations that I think are on the mind of someone who has been appointed to the Supreme Court for life and presumably is thinking forward to a lot more terms than just this one.
Is it fair to call John Roberts the most powerful, or maybe the second most powerful person in America, given the dynamics that you've laid out here?
I mean, he's one of the most powerful people in America right now, for sure. I mean, Anthony Kennedy was in this position for a long time, too. When you have one person on the court who is sort of consistently breaking ties, that person has a tremendous amount of power. And, you know, the court can only rule on things that are brought to them. So it's not like John Roberts can decide that he wants to start weighing in on anything that he thinks is a problem or anything that's interesting to him. But yeah, he's an incredibly powerful Chief Justice. And, you know, I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens in future terms when it's not an election year and the conservatives and liberals on the court are sort of continuing to kind of hash out where they are. And this ideological divide has had even more time to harden.
You mentioned that, of course, the Supreme Court is not entirely making decisions in a vacuum, and that public opinion can and sometimes does influence the court. And also, you know, whatever decisions the court makes have to function in a world where public opinion does exist. So I know you've crunched some of the numbers. This term, how often did their decisions line up with majority opinion in America?
I only have data on this for some of the highest profile cases. You know, as I'm sure people know, there are lots of cases that are about more obviously important legal issues, but are not going to be on the front page of the New York Times. But some researchers this year asked a series of questions that were designed to actually figure out how Americans feel about the specific issues in the big Supreme Court cases, which is pretty cool because, you know, just having those all in one place and having them designed to be specifically responsive to the Supreme Court cases is not something that you always get. And when I talked to one of the researchers who designed this, she said that when she got the results back, she was thinking, you know, oh, this is interesting because public opinion basically went in a liberal direction on a lot of those questions. Not all of them, but a significant number of them. And definitely DACA, the public sort of wanting to keep DACA, not thinking Trump should be able to get rid of it, and abortion. And what we see at the end of the day is that the Supreme Court actually is on the same side as public opinion in most of those cases. Not all of those cases, there are a few exceptions. But, you know, this is not, it was a big term, but weirdly, it's not going to be a hugely controversial term, at least where the public is concerned. And you know, it does make me wonder a little bit if this is going to like take the wind out of the sails of some of the calls for court packing, because especially for liberals, this could have been a really disastrous term, and it was much less disastrous than I think a lot of people on the left were fearing.
One thing that didn't quite attract so much partisan rancor, but is interesting, especially for us here at 538, given the name of our site, was a decision about how delegates to the Electoral College or electors at the Electoral College have to vote and whether or not they can be reprimanded for being a faithless elector, essentially voting against the person they were supposed to cast their vote for. How did that all come down in the end?
That was actually a rare high-profile decision where all the justices were basically on the same page. And they said, yeah, it's okay for states to say, electors, you have to vote for the person whose slate you're on. And it was interesting to see that that was a moment of unity because, you know, as we've talked about on the podcast before, and I'm sure we will talk about again, issues around election law are often quite polarizing. But it seemed like this was one where actually the Supreme Court justices were pretty much all on the same page.
All right, well, let's leave things there, and I look forward to seeing the rest of the data once you crunch it and write it up for the site next week. But thank you for now, Amelia.
Thanks so much for having me, Galen.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.